got pregnant at 17 by a drug dealer baby daddy who was destructive and almost killed me. My mom actually cleaned her act up and took my daughter away from me because she saw me self-destructing and didn't want me to. And she took my daughter away from me. And I remember her bringing it over one day. I was working, you know, as a high school dropout, had no other option but working in a club and, you know, bar. And my daughter recoiled when I tried to take her, and she screamed her head off. And I remember my mother abandoning me and me feeling that emptiness and that void. And I said to myself, Trevor, I will never be like you.
So if everybody can give me a warm who you know welcome for Rebecca, let's go.
Let's go. Welcome, Rebecca.
Rebecca, thanks. I'm excited you're here and your book. Okay, this is awesome. I love this because it reminds me a little bit of my story. So your book, Lost Girl, all right, this reveals the raw truth about your journey from rags to riches. Okay, it talks about some of your experiences, child abandonment, sexual abuse. Can you share some pivotal moments or some insights on how your early life served some turning points and propelled you in success with entrepreneurship?
Well, first of all, Trevor, thank you for having me. Super thrilled to be here in Dallas. Great state of Dallas. And, you know, my journey is probably no different than most, you know, Americans or half of America. You know, a lot of dysfunction, a lot of poverty, a lot of addiction, a lot of trauma, a lot of issues. Family, you know, family dysfunction with a capital D. But I'm a border town gal from El Paso, Texas, and grew up in the inner city in El Paso. Back then when you could walk across the bridge to Juarez, now, of course, you can't do that. One of four children, my mother was an addict. Heroin addict was her choice of drug. None of us knew our fathers, and we all have different fathers, with the exception of my twin brother and I, and lots of poverty.
Brother?
I do. I have a twin brother. Yeah, he and I were told we didn't know our father. He was the owner of a nightclub my mom danced at, and kind of a one night stand type of thing. But so growing up in that amount of dysfunction and poverty and addiction, watching my mother in addiction and a lot of mental illness in her life, you know, it really wreaked a number and havoc on my life as a young girl. And you know, I always say it doesn't matter where you start; what matters is where you finish, right? So I could have been into the system as on welfare and as a high school dropout teen mom, started taking my own path of least resistance into drugs because it's the only thing I knew, and didn't really know who I was as a woman. I didn't have an identity as a young lady and as a young woman. And I think that the lack of identity, we have an identity crisis in our culture and our young people today. And when you don't have identity and you don't know your value because you've been told that you're a loser, you know, my middle school and high school years, you know, I took back in the day fundamentals of math, 1 + 1 = 2, because I was stupid. At least I was told I was stupid.
Me too.
Right. Hey, we have that in common, right? And I remember as a young girl, a teacher saying, you know, you're not very smart and you're not going to do much, you know, with your life because you're just making stupid decisions. And she was right. I was making some pretty stupid decisions, but I was not stupid. You know, I was a product of my environment. And I think that, you know, catalyst forward in the transformation that I underwent, which was a long journey for me, did not happen overnight. But the core thing that sort of was a catalyst for me was making a decision that I'd had enough, and that enough was enough. And I watched my mom on welfare her whole life in poverty. You know, our lights getting cut off, having to wait in line at the Salvation Army for my pair of shoes. I depict the first three chapters of Lost Girl to the trauma. And I'd had enough. And, you know, when you have enough and you hit rock bottom, there's really nowhere to sink anymore because you're kind of at the bottom. There's only one way to go, and that's up.
So what was that moment, though? Let's stop for just a moment. What was that moment where enough was enough? You hit the bottom. What was rock bottom? What was going on in your life at that time?
Well, so I was, you know, I'd had my daughter, got pregnant at 17 by a drug dealer baby daddy who was destructive and almost killed me. And the whole story's in the book. But when my mom actually cleaned her act up and took my daughter away from me because she saw me self-destructing and didn't want me to. And she took my daughter away from me. And I remember her bringing it over one day. I was working, you know, as a high school dropout, had no other option but working in a club and, you know, bar. And my daughter recoiled when I tried to take her, and she screamed her head off. And I remember my mother abandoning me and me feeling that emptiness and that void. And I said to myself, Trevor, I will never be like you. Mm. And then at 18, here I am repeating the same generational darkness that my mother was in. And I hated that about myself. I was unfortunately, you know, addicted to drugs as well, and making a lot of bad choices of people around me, and the people I surrounded myself with at the time were destructive in my life. And you know, I was a follower, not a leader like I am today. It is possible, by the way, to pivot and change and become a leader, and take that follower hat off and put that leadership hat on. But, when I, Crystalline was taken away from me, and I remember thinking, I'm in abject poverty. I'm a dropout. My daughter doesn't even know who I am. What am I doing with my life? Mm-hmm. And I had, what I call a God encounter at the moment, realizing that I was not placed on this earth to self-destruct, mm-hmm. but that I had a purpose in my life. And I started surrounding myself with the right people, and met my husband of now 33 and a half years in a little bitty inner city community church that was working with the gangs in East Austin. And, you know, started to all of a sudden figure out I could really change my life around and help people and use my power for good, right? So my power at the time was, I was very outgoing. I thought I was, you know, the life of the party, and, you know, people wanted to be around me, in a bad way. And I thought I could take that and use it for good. And I enrolled in a welfare to work program to get off of welfare. And I landed a job for a woman by the name of Ann Richards. And Ann at the time was the state treasurer running for governor. Mm-hmm. And for the first time in my life, Trevor, the aha moment was, there's a woman in power. I want to be like her.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well,
let's talk about people for a mm-hmm. second. So if I'm hearing you, you had your kind of like breakthrough moment. You saw, you know, your daughter, and you're like, you know what, I have to make a change, mm-hmm. right? And then the change was the people in your environment. Did you move? Did you get out of?
So I did. I was actually living in an apartment at the time. My baby daddy drug dealer got arrested and put away for a while. And it was a chance for me to get away and change. I moved back in with my mom. Started over, you know, started really trying to help myself through positive influences and mentors, started surrounding myself with people that believed in me and would speak possibilities and not my failures in my face constantly.
Would you say that this is maybe a first step for someone that's looking for transformation in their life, whether it be, you know, let's say it could be anything. Maybe they want to stop smoking. Mm-hmm. Maybe they want to change, you know, their career path. Do you think that the people you associate with or your environment do you think that's usually the first step?
Huge. So listen, I am a product of my environment. Mm-hmm. I was a product of my environment early on when I was failing, and I'm now a product of my environment and success. And surrounding your network, the people that you're with, the people you're doing life with, the people you're listening to, who's influencing you, it's huge. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that that's all you need, right? There's other elements of success and steps you have to take. One of the steps, second step I had to take was I had to face my shit. I had to face my stuff.
Accountability.
Yep. I cannot be behaving that way and expect a result of success, right? So I had to walk away from every negative influence, walk away and face what I had done as a young lady at that time. I was 19 years old. And I had to make a lot of really tough decisions to deal with my abuse. You know, I had buried and suppressed all the abuse in my life and masked it with my party self. Mm. I had to deal with all of that. And those are deep, deep things you have to go and deal with and dig out memories you don't want to dig out and talk about to a counselor, a pastor, a community leader, whoever is there to help you. And I had a woman in my life by the name of Donna Reynolds. She's actually here in Dallas, and I'm having brunch with her tomorrow.
Oh, no way.
Donna was a catalyst in my life very early on in my career. She worked for Kay Bailey Hutchison. So Ann went to be governor, then Kay Bailey came in. I worked for Kay. And then I saw this other powerhouse woman. Well, Donna was with Kay, and she was my boss in the government. And she really took me under her wing, Trevor, and showed me a different path.
So how did you get to the stage? Sorry, I'm trying to make sure I follow here. So to get to the stage of some of these powerhouse women, how did you get there?
Well, so I entered that welfare to work program, and part of the process was they helped me get my GED.
Okay.
So I'm a GED. I don't have a college degree. And they would place you in state government through this welfare. It was called the Job Training Partnership Act. Okay. And it was a government program at the time that was trying to get moms off of welfare, single moms off of welfare. I qualified under that criteria. But that was just an entry point, right? I had to then take the steps to learn and to achieve and to transform my thinking, my thought process. My husband, David, who's 10 years older than me, he at the time, you know, is a visionary, and he really challenged me to behave differently. To think different, to even as simple as, you know, why are you still going to the Goodwill to get your shoes? Like, go to Payless or go to Walmart. Like, yes, we couldn't afford a lot, but why do you have to feel like you have to go to the Goodwill? Well, that's where I shopped all the time with my mom. And he's like, we're not buying Goodwill shoes. Go to Payless, go to Walmart, go to Target. And I'm like, oh yeah, I can do that. Just simple stuff, right?
Yeah.
But the people, back to the people piece, the people that you surround yourself with can make or break you. I am a firm believer of that.
100%, 100%.
My wife and I have recently had a conversation about this, and I want to get your feedback or opinion on this. Is, you know, we're the sum of, right, our closest five friends or the people that we associate with, and that's kind of what the mantra is for your success. But oftentimes when we are in a group, we tend to gravitate towards the people that we're above, right? Not necessarily looking for the top five people that will pull us up. Right.
Can you give an example of that?
So, for example, like if you're in a room, you would look for people that you're comfortable with, that you maybe
you're looking for your click.
Above,
exactly.
Your click.
Yeah.
Like in the lunchroom, you're looking for your click.
Yeah.
It's difficult to put yourself in a position where you're reaching up, right, to others and letting them.
So you're like, you what you're saying is it's uncomfortable to go into a room and look for the smartest people.
Right. Or there's a shame factor there, right?
Correct.
So for me, I had imposter syndrome. I had shame. I wasn't a graduate. I was a dropout. I grew up in the East Side. I'm an ex-drug addict. I'm a, you know, single mom. But here's the thing. Pushing past that shame, there is no shame. Like, literally, you shame yourself. Like, there's nobody responsible for shame except you. And so you have to get rid of that shame and think, you know, I am worthy to walk in their presence. I am 100% worthy to sit at their table. And people will notice your confidence. Now, I wasn't always this confident. I've built my confidence over time through a lot of training, a lot of development, a lot of mentoring. But you got to exuberate confidence when you don't feel it. And so when you walk into a room, if you feel like, I want to be around that person because they're successful, you can't think, oh, I can never be around that person because I'm not like them, and sit in a corner. That was me, you know, 35 years ago. But now it's like, you've got to come into understand your value. That goes back to the value and identity and who you believe God created you to be.
That's right.
And it's a lot to talk about in minutes, but there's a lot of power behind believing that you belong and walking in that belong.
Well, there's also something I want to talk to that point. So being the smallest person in your network, for instance, like in my network, I'm literally the smallest one. Okay. Everybody in my network is bigger than me, right? Like, they're these giants. Okay. And they're doing amazing things. It's great. And I love it, actually, because I just had this aha moment. I just got back from 10X stages, and they had you go through and like write down a list of all your champions. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm sitting on all, like I have so many champions that are doing amazing things, and I'm like, they're gonna be the ones to help me to unlock the doors that I need to go through, you know. So
and they level up your thinking too, because all of a
sudden
you're not thinking here, you're thinking here. So super powerful.
So is it safe to say if you're the smartest guy or gal in the room,
pick a different room?
You're in the wrong room.
Yeah. Listen, even today I have 120 consultants. They're all smarter than me. I'm not the smartest person. I believe that I can make myself be smart, but I'm not the smartest person. And leveling up and surrounding yourself with smart people. Most of my staff are master's degrees, PhDs. I want really smart people working for me, because guess what? They're going to kill it. They're going to secure clients. They're going to knock deliverables out of the table so that clients come back for more. So I have always surrounded myself. My jam and my superpower is people. I love hiring, deploying, and enabling the right people to help me be successful.
So on that note, okay, let's talk about that for just a quick second. I know we're kind of going off the story. We'll get back to it. But on that note, when you're hiring somebody, okay, do you look for somebody that has the skill set, the qualities, you know, the requirements, or what's more important, that, or like the drive?
So I do both.
Okay.
I recently did a piece in Texas CEO where I talked about hiring for heart.
Heart.
And they're like, tell us more about that. Hiring for heart. How do you interview for heart?
Think Tony Romo.
Yeah, exactly.
Heart. That's when you think heart.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Like, yeah. Anyways. So, you know, I can train someone to do the job all day long. They can develop an organizational practices, human capital, organizational change, strategic planning, IT. I can train someone on the methodology on how to do a strategic plan. I can't train for heart. Mm. I can't train for values. I can't train for drive. Mm. So I do look at credentials. And as I said, most of my team are smarter than I am in terms of educated credentials. But I also make sure that I apply what I call a behavioral interviewing style to our hiring, which wants to get at the heart of the issue. Mm. How do they do life? What's most important to them? What keeps them up at night? If they're in a scenario situation, what are they going to do? They're on a boat in the middle of the ocean and they've got three people they can save. What's going to happen? It's like you really get at the core of the individual's heart by knowing what's most important in their value system. Mm-hmm. And once I get somebody, I have about 25% of my staff that's all what I call junior, maybe not, they don't have any experience in government. I can train them in government. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that they have heart and that they have the drive to help. You know, I don't want to have to sit and manage and micromanage and, you know, what are you doing? Give me your schedule. No, I want you out of the gate running ahead of me. And that's what makes, I think, a CEO really successful is the right people with the heart.
I love it. I love it. Great answer. Okay, so let's go back a little bit. You start meeting these powerhouse women, okay, and then what happened?
Well, so all of a sudden, I want to be like them. Mm. All of a sudden, I have a line of sight because in my community, in my home, I was to be barefoot pregnant with a bunch of kids and on welfare my whole life. Mm. And so my mother never married. She married for a couple of days and then got divorced just to give me a last name. But she didn't have a family unit. And, you know, when I was 12 years old, and I talk about this in my book, I was doing laundry and cooking and all the dishes for all my two brothers and my little sister because I was the big girl in the house and my job was to do the laundry, to do the cooking. Now, granted, my husband will tell you I'm the best cook. Like I can do anything. So he thanks my mom. When she was alive, he would thank Mama Grace for that. But you know, it was a little backwards at the time because I'm like, why am I the one doing laundry and folding their clothes and putting it in the drawers and cooking? But so it was the first time I saw these power women. And even Donna Reynolds, my mentor, Karen Hughes, who was President Bush's communication guru. She's phenomenal. Like she's bigger than life. She carries herself with confidence. So I started at the bottom, you know, doing the copies and running for the coffee and, you know, being an assistant. And all of a sudden, in a very aggressive period of 6 years, I grew up from being that welfare to work receptionist for Ann Richards to running personnel for the governor of the great state of Texas.
Okay,
Governor
so Bush. I want to dig into that. Hold on. So you went in 6 years from picking up coffee to running things, okay? So what do you think it was? Okay, obviously heart had to have been part of that factor. But what else helped you move so quickly up the ranks?
So there's a lot to be said to grit and to determination and to not taking no for an answer. Mm. And also I have been, I've learned how to be an insatiable learner. Like there's nothing too difficult for me to undertake. You're talking to someone, I read my state government application in that welfare door. Every word is misspelled. The English language was my hood, you know. My husband tells this funny story. When I was working for Ann, I would answer her phones and I'd answer it popping my gum, you know, and he'd say, babe, please spit your gum out. You're not in the hood anymore, you know, and just, it's funny, but it's really not. It's like, yeah. So, but you know, I worked really, really hard, Trevor. Nothing was ever handed down to me. I've worked really, really hard in my career. But I think that people have noticed, my mentors and my bosses over the years have noticed my grit. Mm. I have noticed my determination. And I asked my mentor, Donna Reynolds, you know, Donna, what did you see in me at the time? I mean, come on. I was literally had nothing to offer. She said, Rebecca, you worked so hard and there was nothing that you couldn't undertake. Mm. And your outlook and wanting to be better, to be a better mom, to be a better wife, to be a better employee, you were relentless about learning and taking in as much as you could. And there was nothing that you wouldn't undertake.
So you had a a positive obsession, it sounds like. You had something, mm-hmm. you said you found it, you saw these women, and you just were like, this is
laser
where I,
focused.
This yeah. is what I want, because you had your past, which had some bumps in it. Okay, mm-hmm. and you know, you weren't supposed to be
mountains, not bumps.
You weren't supposed to be anything. Everybody told you you're never gonna be nothing. Your teacher told you you're not gonna be nothing. Okay, and then all of a sudden you see a path, you see a way out, you see mm-hmm. it, right? And it was like, mm-hmm. let's go.
Yeah.
Is that right?
So exactly. So I will tell you, when we moved to Austin, still in abject poverty, we lived with my grandfather, and he was just a horrible. He was an old school Spanish like. Fire and brimstone type guy. But when I got pregnant, this is how dark I was. When I got pregnant, his response to me, because he was a religious zealot, was that baby is born in sin. You need to flush it down the toilet. Mm. So because I wasn't worthy of his love or his acceptance. And, you know, so you go from, you know, you're being told you're stupid. You're being told you're a loser. You don't belong. How do you transform that thinking and all of a sudden become this power woman? Okay, it doesn't happen overnight, but it's a lot of deliberate work, and it's really changing your mindset. It's surrounding yourself with the right people. It's really learning to embrace your failures and using them for your success, because Absolutely. All of a sudden my failures weren't shameful anymore. Like, I'm not going to be ashamed of that. There's a whole chapter in the book on how I barely made Secret Service clearance in the White House.
Oh.
And actually, President Bush read my book. I was just with him in May, and he's like, Becca, that's a hell of a book you wrote there. But he read that story. I said, you think? He read that story, and I'm like, should I put that story in? Why not?
We had Heather Monahan on the show, and she talked about the way to claim your shame.
Okay? I love that.
And to the way to not let it own you is to shine light on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that way you control the narrative. Okay.
Yes.
And no one else can hold that over you. It's kind of like the movie 8 Mile with Eminem. Okay. The last rap battle, he goes to the guy and he just starts talking crap about himself.
You know, that's right.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, I gotta
just takes that power.
Yeah,
back.
He's like, yeah, I live in a trailer park and I got this and I got that. And he's just saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he says, tell them something else they don't know about me. And he throws them the microphone. Mm-hmm. Like, go, tell them something else they don't know about me. He claimed his shame. He took it, right? Mm-hmm. So the guy's like, I got nothing.
Yes.
Right? And so that's how he won the battle. Yes. But to yes. claim your shame.
And now it's about, you know, my mess has become my message.
Right? Ah, there you go.
So it's like, what, you know, yes, I had a mess of a life, but guess what? You know, I turned it around. And that's why when I speak all over the country, and when I talk to women in particular, or we do a lot, my husband and I have a nonprofit, we work with inner city kids, and I have a signature initiative called Girls a Legacy. We were just in Forbes and Fortune on our Girls a Legacy Give Back initiative, where I have these inner city girls that were scholarshiping and mentoring. I tell them, listen, don't worry about all that you're going through right now. Just focus on your education, focus on your learning and your development and the people you're around, and leave that behind, and use the issues that you're dealing with to propel you and be your superpower. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, so much of what we deal with here and the cultural societal issues of America today, and, you know, people are just a woe is me victim mentality. And it's like, no, you're not a victim. Like, you have the power to change that. You know that.
Well, and I want to, okay, here's something I want to ask you. I want to ask your feedback on this. Because I went to Tony Robbins' conference a week or so ago. And they had this illustration up there. And it really was impactful to me. And it said that great times create weak people. Weak people create bad times. Bad times create strong people. Strong people create great times. And it cycles.
That's a powerful. Now,
right? Yeah. And it cycles. So generationally, right? So when you have great times, everything's good, you're going to create weak people. And those weak people are going to create bad times, and so on and so forth. And it just goes in a circle.
Well, and it happens continually, right? I mean, I went through an issue last year with a family member. I mean, it was tragedy for me. And, you know, you love your family member. You want to see them be successful. My twin brother struggles with meth addiction. He's clean now, but he's up and down. And, you know, when he became homeless and wanted my help, it was awful for me not to be able to help him. But I had helped him a lot, and, you know, he needed to help himself. And so when you go through that tragedy and you think, oh my God, how am I going to overcome this? And Trevor, in the middle of my book launch on stage, I had an interview in Florida that weekend. It's like, how do you get on stage and talk about your superpower when your family situation is in the tank? Well, guess what? You just do it one step at a time. You keep doing what you're doing. Even if you take one step back, you take another two steps forward. But everybody deals with tragedy and trauma, especially in today's society post a COVID environment. So many people have, it's kind of developed this thinking of, victim and woe is me and, I can't recover from that. And there's so many issues that are happening in our society, and we just can't let that hold us back from our forward movement.
I agree 100%. And I think the reason why our society as a whole is weak people is because we have actually, as a whole, as a country and everything, we've actually been in some great times. We've had great times. We haven't had a whole lot of, wars and all that stuff. Americans haven't really had anything crazy going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so it's
so
created.
We're due.
It is. It's the cycle.
It's cyclical, right?
It's brewing right now.
And it's like, we got a bunch of weak, and especially, I'm not trying to talk bad about generations, but, they talk about the Z's and all of the, they grew up on Uber Eats and they grew up on, Netflix and everything's just been easy. Like when you really think about it, and even if you're growing up in poverty, it's still easier poverty today versus poverty, 50 years ago.
Yeah. Or right? In other countries, right?
Or other countries. Yeah. Everybody here got a smartphone and a flat screen TV.
Yeah.
Right. And so, we've had great times, and it's created weak people. Mm-hmm. And so, the next cycle is we're going to have bad times.
Yeah, but it is possible, because I was weak, and now I'm strong.
Correct.
It is possible to change that and use it to get your strength. And it doesn't happen through osmosis or overnight. It's a lot of hard work on you.
So you had hard times. So me and you, we have been through some hard times, and it created strong people, right? Mm-hmm. It created strong people. So I love when I heard that in the cycle, I was like, wow, that is so powerful.
That is powerful.
So I'm curious. You got into the program, got into the office, right? in the governor's office and then up to the White House. And I know I'm ex-military, I'm prior service. So
thank you for your service.
Thank you. It's been an honor. But there's the bureaucracies, right? And so you're talking about, moving forward and grit, but you've probably had some defeats along the way. And I know within the office structure in that bureaucracy, it's cutthroat. We know politics are cutthroat, right?
Yeah.
Crabs in a bucket, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
How did you overcome some of those things? What was your experience like?
So I tell this full story in the book, but I remember this was when I was still in the governor's office, and I was working with someone at the time who was in charge that was a kind of a big bully, And not only physically big, but he was a big bully in his style. And I remember me making a decision that I thought I was going to make because it was the right decision, and he didn't like that decision very much. And so he called me into his office. He had this audacious desk, and he's a big guy, and his chair was like towering over you, and he's like, "Rebecca, sit down." And I said, "No, sir, I think I'll stand." Because when I sit down, all of a sudden, I'm down here, and I'm a tall girl, so I'm like, "I think I'll stand," because I want to look him right in the eye. And he just berated me about the decision I had made. And Trevor, it took everything within me to not break down and cry. But I was determined I'm not going to see a man let me cry. The only one that's going to see me cry is my husband. Nobody else. But I was shaken to the core. And then I didn't cry. And I looked right at him and I said, "With all due respect, Mr. So-and-so, I'm hired to make decisions, personal decisions for Governor Bush. And I think I made the right decision. If I didn't make the right decision, then I will reap the consequence of that. But I disagree with your assessment. And I don't think you have all the facts."
Ooh.
And he looked at me. He's like, "That'll be it. You're dismissed." And I said, "Thank you, sir." And I walked out.
Ooh.
And then I went to the bathroom and cried by myself. Then I called my husband. You wouldn't believe what just happened. But you know what that taught me? Number one, from that point on, he did not look at me the same. He treated me like his equal.
Nice.
He actually ended up offering me a job to work in the administration, and I ended up working for somebody else because I'm like, I don't want to work for you. Are you kidding me? Yeah. But anyway, I tell that story only because it's so important for you to stand your ground. Mm. Even if you're going to be wrong, you take the consequence of that. Stand your ground. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I've dealt with bureaucracy. I had the privilege of serving on the board of West Point. When I left the White House, the president asked me to serve on the board of West Point. And we were dealing with a different kind of war, chemical war. And we were sending 19 mm-hmm. and 20-year-olds to the battleground. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these were kids. And so I was, you know, brought my contribution to bear to the academy. And, you know, the types of people that I have worked with and run across in government, you talk about levels and levels of bureaucracy and a way of doing things that is like a brick wall that wow. you just can't even penetrate. And so my style, my team will tell you, if Rebecca encounters a brick wall, three things are going to happen. She's either going to scale the wall, she's going to figure out a way to tear it down, or we're going to figure out a way to work around the wall. But it's not looking at the wall that's there. It's about figuring out how can I be successful in this environment, in this culture, in this situation, in this meeting, without having everything that I think I know I need, right? Gosh,
I got a lot to learn from you, because let me just tell you something. I don't deal well with all the walls. No, it's not the walls per se, but gosh, man, corporate politics and things like that, when you see that stuff, I just like...
I take corporate politics any day over government politics.
That's what I'm talking about.
Take it to a whole new level.
That's what I'm saying. Like, so if you can deal with that, you got some things to teach me, to download for me, because I'm learning how to work through and navigate some of that stuff.
But a lot of those things will be your superpower and lesson on how you will do it different, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't change. You know, I'm a big believer in the serenity prayer. You know, figure out, you know, grant me the grace to, you know, not try to fix everything. And then within my own sphere of influence, I'm going to do what I can to change things. And so, you know, sometimes it's little baby steps at a time, and you can't take it all on at once.
So how did you, you're in the government, because I know... I've got a friend. I served with him, and he went on to the Pentagon. He was actually at the Pentagon during 9/11, one of the first responders there. And he's still involved. It's kind of like when you get sucked into this government kind of mm-hmm. environment, you get sucked in. You're there.
Yeah.
So how did you get out? I mean, obviously the administration changes, so there's some things there that are done for you.
Yeah. So I spent a total of 15 years in government as a government employee executive, became an executive. When I was in the White House, I was honored to be commissioned. So I was a commissioned officer representing President Bush for hiring decisions. And, you know, the only thing that does in D.C. is it just gives you the access to know you've got the president's signa behind you, seal, right? And people will listen to you. And everything in D.C. is about power, which is a little difficult to deal with. You know, a little Texas girl from the border town, I'm coming into D.C. with all these power people. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I first went into the White House, I was the least qualified for the role, least qualified. And that really overwhelmed me because I started to get the imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah.
And then at the time, Senator Trent Lott was speaker, and he apparently I didn't treat one of his big donors right and made him go through the interview process like everybody else in America does and didn't give him the red carpet. And so I got a complaint to the chief of staff that, you know, this Rebecca doesn't know who I am type situation. And I got called in to the White House, to the West Wing, by my boss, Clay, who's president's best friend in Andover and Yale and one of my top mentors ever in government. He's still a friend today. And I thought he was going to, like, call me on it and, like, sit me down. I thought I was going to get fired because I didn't know who this powerful guy was, right? And he said, Rebecca, we just got a complaint. You know, you did this and this and this. And I was like mortified. Well, I didn't know who he was. Am I supposed to treat him different? Because I'm just the kind of person that treats everybody the same. Hey, listen, I come from, you know, a background that you treat everybody the same. You're not going to give, you know, people preferential treatment. And maybe they are a big donor. Maybe they're an important person. But they're not more important than the person that's applying off the street, right? So he said something to me. I said, well, sir, I apologize if I didn't know who he was, but I really feel like he needed to go through the process that everybody else does, and I'm hired to implement a process. And he said, Rebecca, I want you to know we told him she's doing exactly what she needs to do, and the President Bush has confidence in her. Mm. And we don't want her to know everybody in D.C. because we don't want her to play the D.C. game.
Mm.
And I felt so empowered by that. I made the right decision. Boom.
Drop some mics.
Yeah. But that's the kind of people I grew up under. And, you know, this man has mentored me for 20 years. And he's an incredible person. He's an MIT Yale grad. Brilliant. but he's a practical, no-nonsense manager. And that really made me feel really, really good about what I was doing. And, I've learned in DC not to let any of the power stuff affect me, because at the end of the day, hey, listen, my kids and my husband keep me humble, and they're like, okay, we need breakfast, we need dinner.
So how important is that to have someone that believes in you like that? Like, what did that do for your confidence? What did that do for you? Like, you know what I'm saying? Because I know in my life, I've had some times in my life where people I looked up to believed in me, saw something in me that I didn't see, right? And it absolutely propelled me. Did that do the same for you?
It did, but you know, it's a life-changing thing that will literally just last you forever, right? But it started not with the President of the United States believing in me. It started when I first got married. I had zero value in myself, and my husband will tell you, you know, we tell this story where in the book where literally we're arguing, you know, normal argument couples, and I'm like sitting in the fetal position rocking myself, and he's like, what is wrong with you? Like, get up off the floor. We're having a conversation, but I was traumatized, you know. But, you know, my husband said something to me recently, because we like to like a debrief, you know, every time I do an event, and he's like, babe, I want you to know I always believed in you. And from the beginning, before you were this power person, he saw some potential in me, as in Donna Reynolds, my mentor. When people see the potential in you, Trevor, that you don't see in yourself, it's very powerful.
Oh, so powerful. Imagine a world, okay, where we speak that life into people more often. Imagine a world where that is, right? I love doing that. I love when I see somebody and I see something in them and I can speak it into them and just watching their light bulbs go off. Like, I love doing that. Mm-hmm. I don't think people do it enough.
No.
We're so busy tearing people down, right?
Self-consumed with ourselves that we don't think about that other person. Yeah.
Yeah. But imagine that. So, audience, I want you to take a moment and think about that for a second. And, like, think about who's in your network, who's in your sphere. Go speak life over those people. Go tell those people what they're good at, what you feel their gift is. And it's also important, too, to ask the people around you, hey, what do you see in me? What do you think my gift is? Mm-hmm. Right? What's my superpower? Right? Get feedback, because it may be something you're not really aware of.
So important. Trevor, my husband and I, through our nonprofit Launchpad in Austin, we've served thousands of inner city kids. These are what my husband calls diamonds in the rough, mostly Hispanic and Black kids that are inner city single parent homes. And when you see us speaking potential into them, when David says to a 15-year-old boy who is, you know, not loved at home and completely neglected, hey, I love you, you have value, and you're smart, you're going to do something with your life. Mm-hmm. When you look into the eyeballs of a young person, young adult, or even, it doesn't even have to be a young person. It could be a single mom who's struggling and a wife who's going through a divorce. And you say, you know, I believe you're going to make it through this. Mm-hmm. You are absolutely. I recently have a very good friend of mine who's amazing, bigger than life, and she's going through divorce. And she was really struggling with that. And, you know, I said to her, I said, I know you're going to make it through this. Not only are you going to make it through it, but you're going to thrive in it. And your life is not over because your 30-year marriage ended. Like, you didn't, you know, you can move on. And so just that I love you when you say speak the possibility in the life. It's a really powerful thing that I believe every person needs to understand, that they have possibilities. But who is going to really understand it unless we go around and spread that in our communities, in our sphere? It doesn't have to be on stage where I am. It can be your next door neighbor. Yep. It could be, you know, a homeless person on the street. It could be anybody that you come in contact with.
Absolutely.
I see that because I have young kids. I've got a 9, 7, and 5-year-old. And we do that for our kids, right? We speak that positive confidence building. Most loving parents, I think, would want that and try to do that. But it's not just for kids. I mean, we constantly need that, right? Yeah. And I think that's important. So I'm glad that you continue
absolutely
to do that.
And even this situation that my twin brother just went through, we were with him in San Antonio. We're going to go see him again in a couple of weeks. But, you know, he's coming out of homelessness and, you know, kicking meth. And, you know, we sat with him. We hadn't seen him in a year and a half because it was important for him to get clean and get healthy. And, you know, to watch my husband look into my twin brother's eyes. This is a young man who we were inseparable before we got married. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were bonded and we did everything together, bad stuff and then some. He continued in the path and I got off the path. But when I watched my husband that day look into his eyes and say, "We want you to know we believe in you and you have value in life still," because he's 54, you know, he's like, you're doing all this stuff and I'm homeless, and we're speaking possibilities into him. Is he going to get it right? Is he going to probably slip? Maybe. But it doesn't matter. We're speaking life into him. And he knows that he's loved in the middle of his mess, that we believe he can come out of it strong. And I think every humankind wants to know that they have value and potential.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you think is the difference? Okay. Because, I mean, obviously we've been talking about your story today. And, you know, you made a decision and a commitment, sounds like. That was kind of step one. It was like, I am not going to be my mother, right? Mm-hmm. I'm making a commitment, drawing the line. Here we go. Is that the difference? I mean, obviously, there's a bunch of different things that, throughout your story that we've talked about today. But what's the difference between you and, like, your brother where he didn't get off the path? Is there one thing, or is it a multiple things?
So I can tell you, unfortunately, my family struggles with severe mental illness. Mm. My mother was in depression. My brother struggled with bipolar depression, schizophrenia. There's depression in our family, and I can tell you that it touched on me. I was a little psycho, my husband can tell you, early on. And I think lots and lots of therapy and healing. I'm a big believer in trauma therapy. Okay. And I'm a big believer in... we've already talked about the mentoring power and making the decision and grit to change. I think that the number one difference between him and I right now at this point and over our life has been I made a commitment and I stuck to it. And I also had a partner. Mm. He has not. I had a partner in my corner that would not settle until I embraced my transformation.
Oof.
And you know what? It's important you pick the right partner, because if you and my partner's not perfect, he's very flawed. Trust me, as am I. But one of the things he has always done is he's drawn the line and he has said, "You're not going to live in dysfunction." So an example of that, Trevor, is early on, I always took care of my mother and my twin brother. Like whatever they need, I dropped. Mm. And my husband in that first year said, "You are not their mother." Mm. You got to let them take care of themselves. I get that you're going to support your family, but you got to draw that line because you're not healthy and they're not healthy and y'all are in this unhealthy mess. So having a partner to hold you accountable, and maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a mentor, maybe it's a boss. For me, it's a partner and my husband. And then making those tough pivots and decisions to not go back. So going backwards sometimes can be very disempowering. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? I mean, you know what, if you make a decision to stop smoking because it's not good for your health, then don't go back to smoking. Even if it's only I have a friend of mine who's like, "Well, I stopped smoking. I only smoke a cigarette a week." I'm like, but you're still putting smoke in your lungs. Like you made a decision to stop smoking, so stop smoking. And, you know, trying to make sure that you, and it doesn't mean perfection, it just means you strive towards that excellence and that decision making. Mm-hmm. But the commitment and the grit to persevere and stay the course with what you're making a change in, making better, healthy relationship decisions. I talked to a young lady the other day, I'm mentoring, stop dating narcissists. Narcissist. She's like attracted to narcissists. I'm like, they're not healthy for you. Like, stop dating narcissists. Well, I don't know how. Okay, we'll figure out a way to figure out how, right?
Yeah, or get some help. Right?
Or get some help. Yeah. So I think the decision and then the commitment to stay the course.
Yeah.
I was under the leadership of President Bush for 12 years, and I have never met a more resolved man in my life. He has a resolve that is so deep in his soul. And a lot of people don't understand the decisions that he made when he was president. Nobody will understand, unless you're president, what it takes to make those tough decisions. But you can never move him. Once he made a decision, he was sticking by it, like against popular opinion, you know, sticking by people. He's a really resolved leader, and he doesn't waver.
Yeah.
It's not, he's just resolved. And, right. And my boss, Clay Johnson, who's his best friend, is also like that. So I learned under two resolved men that had grit and resolve, and they were not movable.
Mm. That's amazing. That's a great quality. It's like you've got to be committed. So, okay, so I'm hearing you. I'm hearing your commitment, determination. You found something that was a positive channel for your energy and that just drove your energy, right? And then, okay, so now you're working for the White House. Then what happens?
So I served in the White House for a couple of years. And then President Bush, when I finished my portfolio, I was in charge of 1,200 positions of hiring people to work for him. When I finished that position, I was appointed to go be corporate head of HR for Department of Treasury, about 120,000 people. So I was essentially the corporate head of HR for all the agency. And it's where I cut my teeth in what I call the management consulting side of what I do now. So now I figured out after I left government, I'm like, you know, I really love this consulting thing.
What
I love
made you
fixing
leave?
People. So I left government because I thought at the time we left to come back to Texas. My mom was struggling with cancer. She had just gotten diagnosed a few years before, and I really wanted to be near her through that battle. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I was, because I lost her at age 62 about 10 years ago. But I was here with her, taking care of her. Our relationship got a lot of healing during that period when I was here. But I left government because I wanted to, my husband and I both wanted to go back to the community and start our nonprofit work.
Got it.
And he had left his full-time paying job, making very good money, to start our community outreach nonprofit. And one of us had to make money because we couldn't both be not making money. So I wanted to go into corporate America to make money because he was starting and building the social part of our, we're social entrepreneurs and business entrepreneurs, and investing his time in the inner city. And so I started cutting my teeth in consulting and figured out I'm really good at it. I joined a tiny, tiny firm in DC, by the way, and I was commuting 15 years back and forth every other week.
Okay.
And built their practice into a thriving $7 million practice. And I said, you know what, I can do that for myself. And my top mentor said, you know what you're doing for him, you could really do for yourself. I had never been an entrepreneur and never took a class in business, nothing. But I decided, hey, you know, why can't I do that? Sure, I can. Yeah. I could be a woman entrepreneur. And I opened the doors to my federal practice, government practice, in 2011, and with a partner that he's in DC, he's an IT guy. And we started the company together. I'm the face of the company and the developer of the company. He's an IT guy. And we're patent owners of a software program he developed. And so I'm now a patent owner and have a co-patent. But it's so important to know that sometimes you got to just take that leap of faith and jump out and do it. You know, you can talk about what you want to do for your dreams. I knew that we needed to build what I call generational wealth to do what we needed to do with our inner city outreach work. And I also wanted to change the trajectory as a woman, because so many women, I think, get caught up in, you know, how do I build that generational wealth? How do I build that portfolio? You know, most of the time men can do it really, really well. And women now are beginning to do it really, really well. And I really wanted to build something for our family. And obviously throughout this entire process, you know, having a partner that was neck and neck with me, supporting me and helping me manage the home front while I was in DC every other week for 15 years, you know, that somebody's got to stay home and like take care of the kids. And our son was, you know, I think in second or third grade, and, you know, he was young, he was little. And so it's been an amazing journey. So I started the business about 13 years ago and have really found a knack in taking my expertise and my network and making money from it.
I love that. I mean, it's in the book, it's in the title here. It says, you know, from the hood to the White House to to millionaire entrepreneur. I love that. I have a question for you. It's a little bit interesting kind of a question. Okay. So we just talked about that Tony Robbins circle, right? We talked about, you know, great times create weak people create bad times create strong people create great times, right? So you had bad times, created a strong person, okay? That strong person is creating great times, okay? Now, the family unit and what you're doing, if you go by the cycle, it says that the strong is going to create weak people. So talk to me about your kids and your family. I know it's such a crazy question.
Well, listen, our kids are freaking oxes.
Let's go.
They are rock stars.
I want you to break the cycle.
I broke it. It's done.
It's done.
Over. Both David and I have broken the cycle of dysfunction and weakness.
Let's
and,
go.
You know, it's funny. We joke about, we were literally, I was at an event last night with a bunch of women CEO entrepreneurs in Dallas, and they were like, man, we love your power. I'm like, you should meet my husband. We have this power struggle. But we complement each other's, right? And, you know, we raised two amazing kids. We took our niece in when she was 17. She's 35 or 36 now. And she's part of our family, Alicia. She's my niece's daughter. And, you know, all our three, you know, our two children and our niece, they're all incredibly, incredibly strong kids. Mm. Are they perfect kids? No. But they're our son, who's a producer in L.A., and he's 30, and he just actually came off a tour. His artist opened up for ZZ Top.
Let's go.
So dad's nice. Band, you know, he's older than me. So they were like, let's go see him. But he's a producer. He's got, you know, he's got a couple of artists he's working with that are just amazing. And is on sold a song to Rihanna, so that's a big deal.
Nice.
Yeah, and he's just bigger than life. He's in LA, he's living his dream, and he's 6'5" and looks exactly like his dad, gorgeous. So he's a little bit of a chick magnet, but he's super smart and laser focused. That kid will be in the studio 14 hours a day. Our daughter, my miracle baby, which I talk mm-hmm. about, she's amazing. She's been on my team for about 7 years. She manages the entire brand, and she just kills it. She went and did, I was in Nashville and couldn't do an event with a bunch of retired officer army wives in their like 80s. And she went and did the event for me, and they loved her. You know, she's confident. She's you know, resilient. She's married 10 years now and has given us the two grandbabies.
Let's go.
And then my niece daughter is a senior recruiter, and she kills it. And, you know, that doesn't mean that our kids have always been, you know, rock stars. We've had a journey with them.
Sure.
But one of the things our kids tell us that they've seen is they've always seen us consistent and always seen us love them where they are. Mm. And not try to fix them. Mm-hmm. Our son is an example of that. Mm-hmm. He's like, you and dad, my friends, I can talk to y'all about anything, and my friends don't have that. And so, you know, it's so important. You know, we have friends that have kids that aren't doing well, and they were great parents. You can't ever predict how your kids are going to turn out. All you can do is work really hard,
sure.
teach them the values that you aspire to, you know, to have every day. And we have a very strong fundamental faith in our family as well. And sometimes that faith is our core, you know, it drives us. So our kids have kind of emulated that, and we're really proud of them.
Well, I love that, because it sounds like, you know, you broke the cycle. Okay. And, but there's probably some good lessons in there, right?
Oh,
because
gosh.
I think what happens, or what's happening, is you've got some parents that, you know, again, they're in great times. Okay. And it's too soft for the kids. There's no discipline, there's no structure, there's no none of that stuff, and the kids get to do whatever they want to do.
Well, listen, I am not the disciplinary. My husband is the disciplinary, and we had to play good cop, bad cop, you know.
So how important is then the family unit?
So important. We were literally just talking about this morning. The family unit is central to the success of America. It just is. And I'm really saddened that we've gotten away from valuing fathers and the role that they play, the family unit. And then, hey, listen, David grew up in a single parent home. My mom was a single mom. I was a single mom. Mm. Single moms are amazing. They're some of our heroes.
Absolutely.
But there's so much power between that family unit. And I think it's because it's been diminished. And
yeah.
Well, and I think there's a role, right? So, you know, with women, you have like with mothers in general, they're nurturing and loving and I think a lot more accepting even than necessarily a father might be like, right?
Yeah.
And it plays a role, especially with boys, especially with boys. And boys need we need both. Everybody needs both. Let's just put it that way. But a boy definitely needs a man to say, okay,
yeah.
We're not dealing with that. We're not going to do that today, okay?
Right.
And again, because otherwise, me with my mom, I remember I would try to push my weight around, okay, when I was a young boy, right? And I would try to see how much I could get away
yeah.
with. And it's a lot easier to try to get away with stuff with women than it is with your dad, who's going,
Yeah.
No.
No, we had in our home, especially when I was working in the White House 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, dad was at home. And then 4 months later, President Bush appointed him to a job, and he served in the administration as well. But he was home the first 4 months of our transition to DC. And, you know, he my daughter would call. She was an eighth grade teenager. And, Mom, you know, Dad, I'm don't talk to me. Go talk to your dad. But I was always the easy one that, you know, they come around. Don't tell Dad. Oh, you got to tell your dad.
Yeah.
But you know what? You need that healthy balance.
You do. You need both.
Yeah. Some in our family criticized us because we were too strict with the kids. The kids are amazing. There's a reason why structure and strictness works. Alana Cardona and I had this conversation she was in Austin about the bringing back the value to the family unit here in our country. Mm-hmm. Because and the structure, kids need to have structure. They weren't meant to raise themselves.
Well, and I love that you're saying that because it's not anti-feminist.
No.
It's pro-family.
Pro-family.
Right? And there's a difference. There's a difference, but some people take that narrative and they twist it and it.
Well, yeah, they do. They definitely do. You get all that twisted, but they're not pro family.
Right.
No. Those people aren't pro family.
And
they're trying to twist
it. A neighborhood cannot raise your child.
Mm.
You are responsible for your child. I have been very successful, guys. The number one job that brings me the greatest pride is my children.
Mm.
And I am their matriarch. And I'm proud of that because I didn't have that. I didn't have a mother. I didn't know what a mother looked like. So I was able to change that for my own children, which is such an honor.
Well, this has been an honor. Rebecca, seriously, thank you so much for being on the show. Guys, you need to make sure you go pick up this book, Lost Girl, okay, from the hood to the White House to Millionaire Entrepreneur. Make sure you pick this up. Rebecca, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been so fun, and Godspeed to all you're doing.
Absolutely. Guys, that's the show. It's all about
who you know.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Who You Know Show podcast. My name is Trevor Houston, and if you've enjoyed this episode, consider subscribing wherever you listen and leave us a positive review to help us keep the mics on in the studio. Until next week, that's the show. It's all about who you know.